seen in action and still is today. His buddies came back, but he had to stay. He can't remember a day without pain. He lives with fear of going insane. His life's like a story, it's too sad to tell. He dreams about heaven and wakes up in hell.
Welcome to the part two of the Baron 52 mystery, the crash investigation. Today's featured guest is aviation archaeologist, Colonel retired Ralph Wetterhahn. Ralph has become a real-life Indiana Jones traveling the world in search of aircraft wrecks, our nation's missing in action, and the amazing stories these discoveries have revealed. Ralph's documentary efforts have appeared on NOVA, the Discovery, and National Geographic channels, and he is widely read in Air and Space Smithsonian, MOAA's Military Officer Magazine, Popular Science, Leatherneck, and VFW Magazine, among others. He is also the author of four books, including The Last Battle, which won the prestigious Colby Award. In this episode, Ralph will delve into the investigation of the mysterious Baron 52 crash. Ralph's extensive knowledge of military aviation, coupled with his experience as a combat pilot, makes him the perfect person to help uncover the behind this tragic event. So please sit back as we continue to explore this episode of the Baron 52 MIA mystery.
When I got to realize how Ralph did his investigations, first of all, it was hands-on in the jungles. I was impressed with what I was watching. And I said, there's some way I need to get in touch with this guy called Ralph Wetterhahn. And I managed to get him through the white pages of the internet. And that's where our relationship began, where Baron 52 is concerned. And Ralph was immediate to accept an invitation to come aboard my quest back then to begin to cipher and dissect what happened to Baron 52. And I needed someone of Ralph's expertise. And Ralph will explain that he was government trained to be a crash investigation analyst. So, and this is Ralph, when you were, I believe, still active duty at that time, is that correct or incorrect?
No, I was retired. But one thing I never told you about that is John called me over the phone, and at that time I was flat on my back in bed because I'd messed up the sciatic nerve on the right side doing exercises to prepare for my next expedition. So I was out of action. And he says, do you want to look into this crash? I'll send you all the information. And, and I quoted him my hourly rate and he sent it. And I looked at those pictures and that started it. And here we are today, so many years later. But it sure made for a nice way to recover from sciatic nerve pain. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, that would.
And real quick, at a courtesy to Ralph, he quoted me his hourly rate, but eventually Ralph went pro bono. He began to realize that this was bigger than what he had anticipated. And then he got personally involved in trying to figure out why there were so many things that didn't make sense to him as to how the government had the crash file. And he then decided that he was no longer going to charge our family. And here we are today. Ralph, if you could pick it up from there.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Thank you, Ralph.
Yeah, well, you know, Mary was there in Washington along with John M., and she witnessed how their family was treated by DPAA, which was, to me, a real embarrassment. The whole family comes, and they're denied the use of their own facilities to make the presentation. They had to go to the government facility, no cell phones, no tape recorders, and a very limited amount of time. And you can see from that, what I showed you here, this 71 section document full of information, and trying to present that amount of stuff in an hour and a half is problematic. And it was almost intentional to prevent the evidence from being presented properly. And the other thing that was important is nobody in that room that the family was presenting the information to was going to be involved in the eventual decision about whether Joseph Metro would be declared MIA. That was going to come from the Air Force, and this information would be presented to them later, and they would have no idea what happened for that hour and a half. And of course, as it turned out, apparently a lot of the evidence never got passed to the Air Force. It was just treated as though it wasn't there in the first place. So if you want, we can begin with some of the evidence that is there and was either misinterpreted or overlooked by the government throughout the years. And for those of you that aren't aware, back in 1992, there was a Senate session looking into missing in action that was convened. And during that session, one of the DPAA individuals, Robert DeStat, was the key witness representing the government position on the missing in action versus KIA. And he began by discussing the crash, when it took place, the timing, all of that. And then he pointed out that a radio intercept was received, according to him, 46 minutes after the aircraft went down, that indicated the North Vietnamese had captured four American air pirates. The problem with that statement is it was incorrect. The 46 minutes was how long it took the radio operator that intercepted that radio transmission. It took him 46 minutes to translate it and then forward it down to headquarters. The actual transmission was made 5.5 to 6 hours after the aircraft went missing. So the point the stop starts out with is that it's impossible for have an airplane crash and 46 minutes later, somebody has gotten to the crash site, captured four guys, and managed to get a radio signal off. I said, it's too fast. Well, yeah, it's too fast because that's not what happened. It took 5.5 hours for that message to be sent. And there were AAA sites, even according to Mr. DeStat, that were within 6 miles of that crash site. So how long does it take you to go 6 miles over dirt roads in Laos? Hour, maybe, you know, 6 miles an hour. I think you'd probably do that. So you're there in an hour, you capture four guys, spend an hour going back if you need to. Maybe you got radios with you, but it's well within the time frame to get that message off. The second thing that he said was that the PJs, the pararescue men that went down and investigated the wreckage, claimed that there was no evidence that anyone had bailed out. But they also point out that the rear cargo door was missing from the aircraft. Now, when you bail out, you remove the rear cargo door. So how can he say, in the one hand, you know, that the SAR team saw no evidence that anyone had bailed out? The cargo door is missing. That's evidence, period. May not be conclusive evidence, but it's evidence. He also claims that the aircraft, according to the SAR team, went straight in, bounced once, and landed on its back. So I watched that testimony, and I was frustrated because I wanted to ask Mr. Destat this question. I was going to ask him that I assumed that he owned an automobile, and if he drove that automobile at 120 miles an hour into a bridge abutment, what would happen to the front end of that automobile? And the answer, of course, be crushed. But if you look at the overhead photograph of the crash site of that EC-47, you'll notice that there is no permanent deformation to the nose of that aircraft, meaning in archaeology terms, no dents. It didn't crush the nose. So there's absolutely no way that that aircraft could go straight in and not damage the nose. Well, what does that mean? It didn't go straight in. And in fact, and we can bring up the photograph of the appropriate photograph, and you can look at it and see. And here it is, although it's kind of hard to see. At the top there is the nose, and there's some brush leaning over it. But you can see that the front end of that nose is still there. And it's impossible for that to happen. Yeah, there you go. It's impossible for that to happen if the airplane went straight in. Now, he also claims it spun. Well, if it spun, then where's the extended portions of the wings? You can see the wings have separated due to shear. Shear is one of the ways that things get deformed. And shear happens, for example, if a wing strikes a tree as it's traveling through bamboo grass. Okay? So a spin wouldn't cause that type of separation on the wings, right? And so his whole premise is completely false and shows a lack of understanding of crash dynamics. And he's got the photograph right there in front of him to look at. So that's my key point in all of this. Now you'll notice also in this photograph, look at the bottom there, you'll notice the tail section has separated from the fuselage. What does that mean? That means the whole back section was wide open. So if that aircraft has gone through bamboo grass, and Destat points out that that's what the terrain involves, bamboo grass, that's going to slow the airplane down. And once it stops, all you got to do is unstrap, drop from what is now the top of the airplane, or from the bottom of the airplane to the top of the airplane, and crawl out the back end. You don't even need the cargo door to be open. It's just wide open in the back. You can work your way out and you're clear. Now you're probably pretty banged up, and that may be why they got captured, because they were unable to move to safer place. I don't doubt that a bit. So the point of it all is, if you're DPAA, your job, your mission statement is to conduct operations for full accounting. And yet here, they've done everything possible to prevent full accounting. And I don't, frankly, don't understand that. And one of the things they did way back in 73 was go to the commander and ask him to declare these people, all 8 crew members, dead, KIA rather than MIA. And they failed to show him that message that indicated 4 air pirates had been captured, you know, the night of February 5th. Now, he declared them KIA on the 22nd of February, so that's 5/22, that's 17 days later. Now, Air Force Manual 30-4 is very specific on how you treat these matters. And they're very important because it involves next of kin, grieving families, financial compensation, promotions, all kinds of things are involved here. You just don't decide they're KIA without explicit evidence. And in the case of aircraft that are down behind enemy lines and are crewed by more than one crew member, you must positively identify all of the people on board as being dead. And if you don't recover the bodies, you can't declare them KIA. That's right there in the message. So they violated that message back then in 73, and they knew it. They had to know it. I mean, that's their job when you're doing this determination, is to know the rules. And they violated the rules. So why did they violate the rules? And as has been brought out in these investigations that we've done, they violated because it was going to interfere with the peace process. And on January 30th, of 73, Kissinger signed the peace accords with the North Vietnamese. And 2 weeks later, the first POWs were due to come out. And then on the 5th, this airplane goes down in Laos. And if you read section 2 of that peace accords, it says you're not supposed to conduct combat operations in the airspace over Vietnam, et cetera, et cetera. So there they were over Laos, which isn't exactly Vietnam, but how are they going to interpret that was the concern, I'm sure. And if you add 4 more POWs after the peace accords have been signed, that muddies the water. And I think what's important is that from what John Matichov has told me, is the family isn't concerned that they took that action back then. They wanted to get our POWs home. Where the problem is, once they're home and the war's over, then it's time to correct the record and see about trying to locate Joseph Matichov. And that's what didn't happen. And that's my concern right now. So that's a pretty quick run through. I want to point out one thing. They went back to Colonel Humphreys sometime later and asked him, would he change his mind? Had he seen that message about the 4 air pirates? And he said, no, he wouldn't change his mind, which bothers me in the first place. But I can guarantee you one thing. There was another message on 6 February, written by Sergeant Mooney, and then another one on 17 February, written by Mooney, both of which are retranslations of that radio message that expanded it and indicated that these 4 air pirates were captured in Laos and were being moved on road toward Vin. And I'm absolutely positive that Colonel Frumpley did not hear about those 2 messages, because there is no way on earth that a competent commander would write off his men knowing that that part of the transmission, had been relayed to him that it was in Laos. So they just withheld all that for, quote, security reasons, which is BS. You know, you can just say we've got information that tends to lead us to believe that there's 4 guys captured in Laos. So we're going to list them as MIA. That's the way it would have gone, period. No question about it.
And John B., if you could bring up the that picture of the hillside where those 2 wings first impacted the jungle, and then maybe we can show Ralph had an animation made of how he perceived the airplane actually to impact on the ground below that hillside. And this aerial photograph was taken by the pararescue people. And it is of the hillside just above the crash site, and just below you can see where the fuselage came to rest. There it is. And you can see the circle up there and those 2 what I call eyeballs. Ralph actually measured that, because the picture had a scale to it. He measured that, those two eyeballs, and then compared them to the wingspan of a 47, the C-47, and they matched. Now, if you were to zoom out there, John B., and we can see it, the arrow points down to that's where the excavation took place, where the main portion of that plane eventually ended up. Now, that is not vertically dive bombing or falling out of the sky like a rock. You can see slope of descent of that aircraft and how it took place. And John, if you could now show that 11-second animation.
Well, before you do that, let me go back to that thing for just a second. I want to point something out. Okay, we're talking about 400 yards there. But look at the cleared area down below. Now, if an airplane goes straight in, you get an impact crater. And on an airplane like a C-47, that impact crater would be about the size of a really good size jacuzzi. But you notice there's no impact crater there. And there's no indication when the recovery team went in there to excavate it in 93 that they saw an impact crater. And I'm sure there's none there because this airplane did not go straight in. And the important thing to understand about a C-47, when you say it bounced, there are bounces and then there are bounces. Okay, a bounce, like bouncing a rubber ball on the ground, is one way to do it. And then there's a skipping bounce, like stones across water. Okay, a C-47 is like a raw egg. If you drop it straight down, it isn't going to bounce. It's going to go splat. I guarantee that because there's not enough structure, hard structure, to hit against something that's hard to get that bounce reaction. So what's happened is this airplane hit and broached. It skipped and got airborne again, and we'll see that. So now you can run the 11-second video there, and you see what likely happened here. There's impact. One wing comes off, goes inverted, comes to a stop, and the tail falls off. Boom. Now, once it broaches and becomes airborne, because it's missing part of that one wing, that's what causes that roll, you know, into the missing wing and gets it inverted. So when that thing hits upside down, then all of the vegetation, trees, branches, and bamboo is going to come through the cockpit and incapacitate the crews up front. But the guys in the back are going to be in pretty good shape. They're just along for a really rough ride. They're going to be bounced along there. And of course, the tail section, because that vertical stabilizer and rudder is now plowing through the ground, that's what causes it to come off. And so that's what you wind up with. And it's pretty clear that that's pretty much what happened. And I defy someone to show me aeronautically how you can get there like that with no damage to the nose in some other fashion. It just doesn't add up.
And we had some discussion about parachutes. It is my firm conviction that the higher potential of those crew members surviving this crash was not from parachuting out, but from indeed riding that plane in and then surviving the crash. And when you go to that jungle picture, that is triple canopy jungle. And that, in my opinion, creates a cushion to where, and if you read a narrative written by one of the squadron commanders, the people that he interviewed pretty much said in the C-47, they knew that if they were going down, that the potential was greater for them to survive if they rode the plane in. That's in that narrative that I have in my possession. So there's a lot of speculation that anybody can make. And oddly enough, I did bring this, and this is a statement by Colonel Humphreys himself that he wrote to my family. And he said, and this one is his opening remarks, he said, "Let me summarize by stating that we did employ a certain amount of conjecture." And there it is in his letter that he wrote to my mom and dad. So when Department of Defense and certain individuals say that the Matajov family, they're making guesses, here's the squadron, here's the commander who actually wrote that in a letter. That's what they did. So when it comes to separating the facts versus what they think they want to say, it comes down to, in my opinion, Mr. Destat, during the testimony, and we're going to show some excerpts from the actual testimony given to the Senate Select Committee, where Mr. Destat himself is making conjectures. And it's almost embarrassing to see some of these experts that excerpts that you're about to see from the actual video, from the testimony in the Senate Select Committee on POW affairs.
Well, one of the things that DPA has maintained is that the search and rescue teams are experts in determining the cause of the crash. But that's a bald-faced lie. They receive absolutely no training. There's not 1 hour of training on crash investigations. And even if they had courses in crash investigation, before you would ever call someone an expert in it, they would have to go out and train and go to crash site after crash site after crash site after crash site, like I have, and learn all the business about metal fatigue and compression and stress and torque and shear and all of this stuff before you'd ever call them experts. And they do none of that because that's not their job. And they're quick to tell you that their job is search and rescue. So when that was pointed out to DPA, they doubled down and said, no, no, they are experts. They are not experts. They're not. And Destat is not. He clearly shows he's not, because he couldn't even look at those photographs and realize that that airplane could not go straight in. He also demonstrates a lack of knowledge, DPAA does, about how radio intercepts are treated. So when that four POW, you know, four air pirate transmission was received by the EC-121, they never got a triangulation on it. To get a triangulation on a radio signal, you have to know your own location. Then you have to get an accurate bearing for that signal. And that's going to take time to lock that in. Then you have to move your aircraft to some other place, know exactly where that is, and take another shot, which means the same transmitter has to be up and running the whole time. Okay, this was a very short transmission. There's no way they had time to do a triangulation. The same is true later on when the survival radios came up online and the OV-10 and I think the B-66 or whatever, the two intercepts were taken. They never triangulated either. But what DPAA did was they said where the OV-10 was located was where the transmitter was. No, that's where the signal was received. It was received on a line off into infinity, some direction. And they said, well, the OV-10 was 50 miles from the crash site. There's no way the guys got 50 miles on the ground. Well, correct. There's no way they got there because they weren't there. They're somewhere else. And there was no triangulation. Now, these guys know that stuff. They know how that works. And yet they just ignored it and looked for some other way to explain all of these things. The VIN business about the original radio signal comes because in the one translation, they mentioned they were going to take these guys to VIN, which is in North Vietnam. So they decided, well, then therefore the radio transmission must have come from VIN. It's just crazy what they, it's like someone had taken them all and said, look, guys, it doesn't matter. You come up with some explanation. We're not changing our mind. And we don't care how shallow it is, just throw it out there. That's basically what you come up with here.
And also in the testimony, if I might add, Mr. Bob Sheets was testifying with Bob Destat, and they were discussing survival radio beacons. And Mr. Sheets goes into a dissertation in which he said, if there were four survivors, you would expect that one, at least one of those four survivors would have turned on the radio. One radio not working, probably. Two, maybe. Three of them not functioning, kind of unlikely. All four of them, not functioning, it stretches credibility. Well, I'm going to go and show you the actual, I'm going to get those documents if you give me a minute here, and I'm going to show you the actual recorded beeper, survival beeper entries intercepted in the actual squadron's logbook that were sent out to seek these survival beacons. And it's prefaced with the words Baron 52. And for some reason, Mr. Bob Sheets and a Defense Intelligence Agency goes on record as saying there were no beacons, survival beacons received. I have the documents that they say didn't even exist. But they go on to say, of course, well, we never had any audio. We never had any attachment of any radio beacons to the crew members of Baron 52, to which you will see that Senator Bob Smith kind of loses it when he hears that, exclaiming to Mr. DeStat how good of an analyst that they are or are not, and how I think he says the words, you're damn good at what you do, in kind of throwing us a curveball here. And I think we're going to pull those excerpts out of that the video. But let me go right now and get those documents, and I'll be right back.
And while he's doing that, I'll mention something about radios that may not be apparent. But the UHF radios, the survival radios, UHF frequency, and the VFM radios, they're straight line. They're not like your AM radio station. It bounces off the ionosphere. So once you're below hill level or you're over the horizon, you don't hear those radios. So DPAA says they made no Mayday radio transmission. And the proper thing they should say is no radio transmission was heard. We don't know that they didn't make one. We just know that they weren't heard. And that's the way it should be treated. The other thing is the antennas, you know, are, you know, if you're turning, the antennas may be pointed away. There's lots of factors involved in that. But more importantly, when you take a hit from flak, which apparently is what brought this airplane down, your first responsibility is maintain aircraft control and treat with the emergency. Nowhere in there does it say your first responsibility is get on the radio and start hollering Mayday. Mm-hmm. Get all the other stuff taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, you may be below the terrain level where that transmission is going to be received by anybody. So, you know, they just come up with stuff that is totally wrong in terms of the way an air crew will operate. And yet they climb on that and use that as justification for why they're all KIA. And it just doesn't sell.
Yeah, and one of the big differences too in those beepers too is it's not like the fighter aircraft where you hit the ejection and you eject and it automatically goes off. These are actual radios where you have to turn them on and make them operate. That's
You got to get the survival radio out of your vest, crank it up, and all of that sort of thing. The other thing that's really important is when they did the excavation in '93, they came up with one tooth. Now, we don't know the exact number of teeth that were in all those crew members because some people have their wisdom teeth removed and all that sort of thing. But approximately 220 teeth were aboard that airplane, and they found one. Okay. They all had survival knives, and they didn't find eight survival knives. They didn't find any wedding rings. You know, the class rings, they didn't find, and I'm sure maybe some of that stuff was scavenged, but I don't think they're scavenging teeth. And even though the anthropologist says he could confirm that one member was killed because of that tooth, here's what I'm saying. If that tooth doesn't have some part of the jaw attached to it, there's also the possibility it was knocked out during the slide through the jungle there while they were banging around. Now, the probability of that's low, but it's not zero. Okay, it's not zero. But I will concede that one tooth probably, you know, indicates that at least one guy died. And the fact that they saw three up in the cockpit area, I will concede that those three, they thought they saw a fourth one back behind there, but that was never really confirmed. But so, you know, I'll give you four, but I can't give you eight. You got to have more teeth. You got to have more survival radio wreckage in there. You got to have a whole lot more stuff from personal item side of it. And you don't have it. You do not have it.
Yeah. Schofield, when he looked at the crash, when he was with the PJ, when they were looking at the crash site or looking at the wreckage, and it was Schofield who only saw three. Apparently the PJ possibly saw the fourth. From my understanding. Now, Heather, yeah. you had something you wanted to talk about here with Humphreys and his access.
Yeah, just kind of going back to talking about, you know, Humphreys' assessment and when that happened and how it evolved. I was looking back at the 1995 DOD Comprehensive Review of Indochina POW MIA cases. And there was some really great information on Baron 52 in that piece. And in talking about how Humphreys' access kind of changed over the course of those couple of weeks in February. This was from February 23rd at 1:15 a.m. Washington time, the Air Force 6994 Security Squadron, which was the backenders squadron at NKP Thailand, sent a message to the Air Force Security Squadron headquarters at Kelly Air Force Base, which stated in part, the status of all crew members aboard Baron 52 has been changed from MIA to KIA. Based on information reported in reference A, which is in this document, the Detachment 3-6994 Security Squadron commander at Ubon, Thailand, feels that there's some doubt as to the KIA status, particularly since there were no back-end crew members' bodies seen or collected at the crash site, nor was a thorough sifting of the debris made. The second point, the 8th Tactical Fighter Wing Commander, Colonel Francis Humphreys at Ubon, Thailand, has asked if there is any redacted information concerning the crash. He apparently held redacted during past assignment, but is not cleared now. So assuming that his status had changed in terms of the type of information he could have access to, it goes on to say, I've told the commander at Detachment 3 at Ubon, Thailand, that neither he nor cleared navigators of the 361st Tactical Electronic Warfare Squadron at Ubon, are permitted to sanitize the information from NSA in the reference message to the secret level, but that I would pass the matter on to the U.S. Air Force Security Squadron at Kelly Air Force Base for decision on release or availability of new information. So that would be a few days after he sent that message on the 17th, Ralph, of him finding out about new information and asking for the proof of that and not having access.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess if I were to sum up the way I look at it, we have DIA claiming that four American pilots or crew members from Baron 52 were captured and died in captivity. We have DPA's anthropologist acknowledging that he can only credit one death from the excavation done in 1993. We have the visual evidence from the SAR team and the guy that was going to destroy the classified equipment of up to a maximum of four corpses in the wreckage site. We have one tooth out of 220 recovered. We have no other personal equipment recovered at the crash site. And we have the Vietnamese saying they captured four the night that the airplane went down. And we have nothing. No evidence that's been presented to indicate that the other four crew members were killed. And you could even go to where they said, well, we've accounted for all eight parachutes by having the same piece of equipment on each one of them show up. But that assumes there's only eight parachutes on board. But they had a bin in the back for spare parachutes. Now, did they have any in there that night? I don't know. But routinely they did, according to the people that flew those airplanes, in case somebody popped one inside the airplane, be nice to have a spare. Or if you have someone that needed to get on board for a VIP mission to see how they do their work, that sort of thing, you'd have extra ones. So they've got no evidence that the four guys were KIA, and yet not they claim that's the answer. It defies logic completely.
And I have these documents that I said I was going to get. And for those of you who can read that, it says secret. These were formerly classified as secret documents. These are the actual log entries that were placed here by personnel receiving intel from beeper signals from survivors. In the highlighted area here is the, and you'll see it, Baron 52, there's a lot of Baron 52 entries. There is an actual, the actual beeper signal received with the moniker of Baron 52 on then classified secret documents that were declassified eventually and declassified and sent to the Library of Congress. And oddly enough, if you can see at the bottom of this page, it says, I don't know if you can get that there, John.
Oh, here, I'll jump back there.
It says, I'm going to read what it says, reviewed by DPMO in accordance with so-and-so. So the people who claim that these didn't exist actually reviewed these documents, DPMO, for releasing them to the Library of Congress when it was DPMO who said that none of these existed. And a friend of ours, Lynn O'Shea from the Alliance of Families, pulled these very documents out of the Library of Congress after they were declassified. So when you see the excerpts from the Senate Select Committee testimony by Mr. Bob Sheets, explaining that there were no survival beacons received, here are the secret documents, declassified such as they are, that just tell you that Bob Sheets was saying things that, and this is sworn testimony, by the way, to the Senate Select Committee, to which Senator Smith just went off on him. He could not believe what he was hearing. When we have these documents. So when they make stuff up, it's amazing to the extent that we have discovered the extent and the depth of the things that they made up. And incidentally, you can see 23 personnel on the top. I wrote there, I actually, there are 23 personnel who made log entries about Baron 52 in these documents. Not one of those personnel were ever interviewed that I'm aware of as to why they made those entries and what it meant to them. Not one of them. One of them is a brigadier general on these documents. So when it comes to things that have been overlooked, I might suggest that aside from everything we're discussing here today and in future episodes, we have documentation to back up what we're saying. We're not just pulling this stuff out of our butts and making our stuff up. We don't do that. Mm-hmm. But people in official sworn testimony before the Senate Select Committee made things up and actually gave false testimony. So that's why we're doing these podcasts, mm-hmm. to let it be known out there for people who have no clue of what we know exists because we possess it, is contradicting the official Department of Defense file case. So we're not trying to blow smoke on this issue. We're coming across to let other people know, your listeners know, John B. This is serious stuff that has been overlooked. And with the help of Heather, and Ralph and everybody here, my sister Mary, who actually attended the presentation in Washington, D.C. back in 2016. She's witness to what they told us they were going to do versus what they did not do.
This concludes episode 2, part 1 of the crash investigation with Ralph Wetterhahn. In part 2, we will air the Senate Select Committee investigation on Baron 52 with DIA analyst Robert Sant's false testimony to the senators. In part 3, we'll wrap up crash investigator Colonel Ralph Wetterhahn's interview. Thank you for listening.
Be proud of this America. Realize.